very pleased to say I have on the phone with me Professor Gary Francione. He's the Distinguished Professor of Law and Nicholas Deby Katzenbach Scholar of Law and Philosophy at Rutgers University School of Law. How's it going, Gary?
Very well, thank you. How are you? Which of the three of you am I speaking to?
Oh, you're speaking to all of us right
all
now.
Oh, okay, very good, very good. Okay, hi.
Definitely.
Hello.
Hi.
Great. So, of course, you are, I would say, the founder of the Abolitionist Approach and the Abolitionist Approach website. You're a distinguished professor of law and an author. You recently have a book out, which I'm looking for the title of that now, if you want to refresh our memories.
It's called The Animal Rights Debate, Abolition or Regulation.
Right, and that's just out. And I wanted to ask you first, you've got six basic tenets up on the Abolitionist Approach website for being an abolitionist and being a full-on vegan. Would you like to outline those for us so the listeners know what we're talking about?
Yeah, basically, the abolitionist approach maintains that animals have the right not to be treated as the property of others. I mean, our institutional exploitation of animals rests on the fact that they're chattel property and that it's all right for us to exploit them. And so if we recognize one right, we don't have to get into any sort of complicated rights theories. All we have to recognize is that animals have a right not to be treated as property, and that in and of itself requires the abolition of all institutionalized exploitation. The second principle is that we should abolish and not regulate animal exploitation. Again, many of the large organizations, I heard you just had Farm Sanctuary on, and Gene, I've known Gene for many years, and I like him very, very much, but I disagree with the approach of Gene and Ingrid and Wayne Pacell and many of the other leaders of the animal welfare movement, because in many ways what they're doing is reinforcing the notion that animal exploitation can be acceptable if it is done properly. That is, humane exploitation is a good thing, or at least a normatively acceptable thing. I disagree with that. I think that sends the wrong message to people. First of all, I don't think it works. I mean, I don't think animal welfare reform works. Because animals are chattel property, animal welfare standards, however ambitious they are, however, quote, humane, end quote, they are, basically amount to torturing animals. So I don't think these standards work as a practical matter. But I also think, as a practical matter, they have the effect of making people feel better about exploitation. Recently, in the past couple of weeks, Whole Foods has come out with this, rolled out this animal compassionate happy meat label program, and it's being supported by PETA and Farm Sanctuary and Vegan Outreach and all of these organizations and Peter Singer. And think about that as an optical matter. If you're out there, a member of the general public, and you say, "Gee, you know, I really care about this issue, but I don't know what the hell to do to put my concern into practice." And then you see, oh, well, you know, PETA and Farm Sanctuary and all these organizations, they're praising the animal compassionate label of Whole Foods, so I'll go and buy my dead flesh and cow pus and other animal products at Whole Foods. This sort of thing is counterproductive. The third thing is that we reject sexism, racism, heterosexism, all forms of discrimination. That is, speciesism is a form of discrimination. It's a form of violence. It is related to all other forms of discrimination, which are also forms of violence. And so, therefore, you know, the abolitionist approach takes the position that we ought to reject all of these forms of exploitation. And obviously, I have been a critic for some years now, as a matter of fact, for going on two decades. I was once involved, believe it or not. Yeah, a lot of you young folks don't know the history of things, and I was very, very much involved with PETA in my younger days, and by the early 90s we were going our separate ways for several reasons, in large part because in some part there were other issues as well, but in substantial part because of the "I'd rather go naked than wear fur" and other sexist nonsense that PETA was promoting. I mean, the bottom line is, as long as we treat women like meat, we're going to continue to treat animals like meat, and I don't really see the utility of the or morality of eroticizing animal exploitation. The fourth principle is, I recognize, despite the fact that I'm lectured about this all the time by my welfarist friends, that we're not going to get rid of exploitation overnight. I've never said that we are going to get rid of exploitation overnight. I've never not taken an incremental approach. My incremental approach is veganism, educating people about veganism. That's how we will change the world. You know, if each one of the roughly 70 million vegans on the planet made one other, you know, convinced one other person in the next year to go vegan, and then that following year, all of those people convinced one other person to go vegan, we'd have a vegan world in about 10 years, perhaps less. So the bottom line is that veganism and vegan, creative, nonviolent vegan education is a very, very important part of advocacy, and it's the incremental approach advocated by the abolitionist a version of animal rights, whereas you have the welfarist people who say our incremental approach is larger cages, cage-free eggs, Proposition 2, all of that sort of stuff, which I think is worse than useless. I think it's counterproductive. That's their incremental approach. My incremental approach is vegan education. Go vegan. If you take this seriously, you don't have a choice. You know, I mean, if you think animals are members of the moral community, then you got to stop eating them, wearing them, or consuming them. The fifth principle is that is the fifth principle that we recognize abolition. We recognize veganism as the step towards abolition. That's also the fifth principle. The fourth and fifth principles are basically rejection of welfarist campaigns and advocating veganism on the individual level and on the social level. The sixth principle is we recognize nonviolence as an important part of the program. I see the animal rights movement as a peace movement. It's a peace movement which encompasses and involves all sentient beings. And I am I am violently opposed to violence. Not only do I think it is immoral and morally unjustifiable, I think it's dumb. If we think about it, I mean, this idea that we should be using violence against animals. This morning, I saw a very disturbing story on AOL about some experimenter in, I think, UCLA, who received razor blades covered with blood in the mail, and there was, you know, from some animal organization. And I have to tell you something. I think that is just, putting aside the immorality of it, it's idiotic when you think about it. The idea of advocating violence against animal exploiters, a number of these pro-violence people are not even vegans themselves. They are animal exploiters. And I'm sure that they have mothers and fathers and sisters and brothers and lovers and whatever who are eating turkey tomorrow. So should they put on their masks and go and do direct action against those people because they're engaged in animal exploitation? I mean, this is the problem. I mean, animal exploitation is pervasive. The idea that we're going to stop it by engaging in violence against certain animal exploiters ignores the fact that animal exploitation is pervasive. And you can burn down 10 slaughterhouses tonight, and you know what? 10 more will pop up tomorrow, or 10 existing ones will expand their production capacity, because the bottom line is those people are capitalists, including the experimenters. They're doing what the public demands to do, what they want done. And I'm not saying corporations don't help to stimulate demand. They certainly do. But in the end, we're the ones making the decisions. We're the ones who are deciding what to put on our mouths, what to wear on our feet, what to put on our backs, what to wash our hair with, etc. If we don't make those choices, then all the yelling, screaming, chest pounding, and heavy breathing of these people ain't going to make a difference. Those are the six principles of the abolitionist approach. I try to get them out as quickly as possible.
Yeah, that's great. Sure, sure. In your latest book, The Animal Rights Debate, Abolition or Regulation, you discuss with the British political theorist Dr. Robert Garner basically the fundamental dichotomy of what I would call, using your phraseology, a humane exploitation, the counterproductivity of humane exploitation, and why the welfare reform approach doesn't work and the regulation approach doesn't work. So maybe you could give us your fundamental argument for abolition in terms of the context of the debate that you engage with.
Sure. I mean, it's partly a philosophical debate, partly an economic debate. I mean, look, animals are chattel property. They're things. They have market value. They don't have intrinsic or inherent value. Those of us, if you have a dog as a companion animal, I'm sure that you don't regard your dog as property. The law does. The law regards your dog as having a market value. If somebody negligently injures or destroys your dog, you can sue that person, and you're generally going to be limited to the fair market value of the dog because the dog is chattel property. So animals are chattel property. They have economic value. They don't have inherent value. They have extrinsic or external value only. And so every time we protect an animal interest, that costs money. And we are only going to protect those animal interests when it's economically justifiable for us to do so. And so as a result, what I argue is that animal welfare standards basically don't require much more than property owners of animals to act as rational actors. Indeed, we would not need animal welfare standards if everybody was rational with respect to their property. Nobody would be gratuitously you know, injuring their animal property any more than you would take a hammer and go out and start, you know, smashing your car in. I mean, no rational property owner would do that. No rational property owner would gratuitously inflict injury on animal property because that would result in an economic loss. So, in a sense, the standards of animal welfare are very, very low because all they're really doing is providing they're providing information on rational property ownership. So they don't go very far. And so the debate between myself and Robert Garner maintains that, well, if we keep on regulating exploitation, we'll eventually get to a point where people will get much more conscious about animal exploitation. And I don't see the proof of that. I mean, we've had animal welfare for 200 years. At some points in history, both British and American and elsewhere, but particularly British and American, we've had very, very intense periods of animal welfare. It hasn't resulted in the abolition of any form of animal exploitation. So, I mean, as a matter of fact, we are exploiting more animals now in more horrific ways than at any point in human history. So I don't see this as I don't see animal welfare going anywhere. I do see it's really interesting. For many years, you know, before the internet, large organizations were able to control discourse about the animal issue because, you know, if you weren't invited to animal conferences, if your books weren't sold by animal groups, your message basically didn't get out. So by the mid 90s, when I basically had said, look, the animal rights movement had fallen apart, and what had emerged was a new form of animal welfare movement. Well, that didn't endear me very, very, you know, very much to the hearts of my friends over at Farm Sanctuary and PETA and those other places. So I sort of all of a sudden went from being invited to all of the conferences to being invited to none of them. There is not one major group in this country that sells my books. So my message was effectively suppressed. In 2006, as a result of, I'm not a technological guy, but as a result of a wonderful fellow who was then working for Apple in California, he put together the Abolitionist Approach website at abolitionistapproach.com, and he put that together. I wrote the substantive stuff, obviously, but you know, he put the site together for me, and within a very, very short time, we've now got a site which gets, you know, 20, 30,000, sometimes more, hits a month, where a podcast I do gets 4,000 to 5,000 downloads. And this is a grassroots movement that is emerging all over the place. And it's clear to me, and I'm just one guy. I'm a professor. I mean, I don't have an organization. I don't have any sort of group. I don't solicit donations. I'm a one person who is out there doing stuff. Yes, I have some help from my students from time to time, and there are other people who volunteer time and work on the site and things like that. But the bottom line is, we're a small group of volunteer people. And what I see happening in terms of the number of people who are corresponding, I can't even keep up with it. I mean, I have hundreds and hundreds of emails every single week. And many people are saying, look, I've gone from being an omnivore to being a vegan because I never thought of it that way. And, you know, I've never heard the message that clearly or that coherently. You know, I'm telling you, it's vegan education is a hell of a lot easier than people think it is. And it's not as daunting as people say it is. And I'm really tired of these large organizations telling us all how difficult it is to be vegan. I've been vegan for almost 30 years. I got news for you. It's incredibly easy. Incredibly easy. It's very disconcerting to me when I hear these large organizations, oh, it's daunting. That's a word they use. They say it's daunting. It's difficult. You've got to encourage vegetarianism. No, you don't. There is no difference between flesh and dairy. Animals used for dairy are kept alive longer, they're treated every bit as badly, and they all end up in the same slaughterhouse. So the bottom line is, you know, this is not rocket science. And people do understand. They do understand the message. I mean, when you say to them, look, why were you upset about Michael Vick and his dog and his fighting dogs? Why were you upset about that? Well, because that's terrible that people will inflict suffering and death on animals, you know, just because they get some sort of pleasure out of it. And then you say to them, yeah, but what about you? You eat animal products. You eat steak. You eat dairy. What are you doing that's any different? And then you have people look at you as if you've just articulated the theory of relativity, and they say, gee, I never thought about it that way. I wrote an essay about Michael Vick in 2007. And it was published in the Philadelphia Daily News. It was quite a large editorial, in which I said, we are all Michael Vick. And that has gotten thousands of replies from people all over the world. And so I really think creative, nonviolent vegan education is easy, it's effective, and if we took all the money that these organizations put into these welfareist campaigns and we put them into unequivocal education, vegan education, and made it clear that it ain't a question of going to Whole Foods and buying animal compassionate happy meat, and it's not a question of going to Kentucky Fried Chicken and feeling you're an animal rights activist because you're eating gassed chicken. It's a matter of going vegan. If you care, it's your only choice.
Thanks, Gary. One of the links I found from Abolitionist Approach is to the Columbia University Press, and you and the other Gary we spoke with today, Gary Steiner, did some editing, Critical Perspectives on Animals, a series that you two edited for Columbia University Press. And
it just started. As a matter of fact, the book that I did with Garner is the first book in the series, and it inaugurated the series. But you had Gary Steiner on this?
Yes, we did.
Oh, he's terrific.
Yeah,
his books are just terrific.
Yeah, and one of the things in the brief interview I did with him that he mentioned was from a philosophical perspective or in the realm of philosophy is that, philosophers, for example, are willing to extend the right of self-determination in a theoretical point of view to other animals so that animals have the right to be unto themselves. But when then there's not the practical aspect of employing that philosophy such that if we're going to give them the right to self-determination because they are fundamentally sentient beings, then we probably shouldn't eat them too. So even in the philosophical realm, in academia, there's that disconnect. But you note, too, that there's another fundamental disconnect and that there needs to be a paradigm shift from the basic nature of the relationship between humans and non-human animals. And I would like you to comment on how do we get that paradigm shift or what's the friction in preventing that shift from both a cultural and a legal perspective?
Well, I mean, look, from a legal perspective, they're property. So, I mean, I understand completely. I mean, that was the subject of my first book in 1995, was to try to explain the legal and economic mechanisms that followed from the property status of animals. But you ask an interesting question in that, how do we shift the paradigm? And the answer is, I don't think you can shift the paradigm. I don't think we're going to ever find our moral compass as long as these animals are sitting on plates or in glasses on our table. I mean, this is the fundamental problem. I mean, although I'm opposed to all animal use and all animal exploitation, I don't maintain that any vivisection is morally justifiable. Any use of animals for entertainment for any purpose whatsoever is morally justifiable. But obviously, the elephant in the room, to use what may be a speciesist expression, and I apologize if it is, although I'm not sure it is, but the vegan elephant in the room is the use of animals for food, because that is 56 billion animals per year. And that's a huge, I mean, that's a mind-boggling number when you think, and that doesn't include fish. So that's a mind-boggling number. Now, as long as we're eating them, then I think we're not going to be able to think clearly about the issue, which is why I think the vegan issue and focusing people's attention on veganism is really necessary for the paradigm shift. And it's interesting, you make reference to the academic issues, and I've been an academic for, I guess, 26 years now, and first at the University of Pennsylvania and then at Rutgers. And I can tell you that if people want to continue to eat meat, and they're smart people, they can come up with really, really creative but ultimately unsuccessful justifications for animal use. I mean, the person I find most fascinating is Singer. I mean, Singer's, I saw yesterday a transcript of a talk he gave in which he talks about how human infants don't have self-awareness until they're like 2 years old. Now, that's interesting to me, because what he means by that is, they're not really able to recognize themselves, and they don't have the sort of the sense of self-awareness that we associate with normal adult humans. Now, whether or not a baby can recognize him or herself in a mirror may be relevant if we have like a hairbrush to distribute and we only have one left. And we should we give it to the baby, or should we give it to somebody who can brush their hair? And the answer is, well, I guess you should give it to the latter rather than to the former. But is the ability to recognize oneself in the mirror relevant to whether we use the baby as a forced organ donor or as a subject in a painful biomedical experiment, etc.? And I don't understand. I mean, you have people like Singer, who is supposedly, our father, the father of the animal rights movement, and he maintains that animals do not have human-like self-awareness, so therefore they don't care whether we eat them. They only care about whether they suffer in the process. And I just find that very, very bizarre because I live with five rescued dogs. And I don't know, I mean, I don't know exactly what goes on in their minds because they don't use language, and I use language, and my concepts are linked to language. But it's also clear to me that they think, because I couldn't explain their behavior, you simply can't explain their behavior without positing some fairly sophisticated cognition to them. But the bottom line is, to say that my dogs are not self-aware because they can't look in the mirror, but and therefore they have no interest in continuing to live, and they don't care if I kill them. They just care about whether I make them suffer. I find that bizarre. I find that bizarre coming from anybody. I find it super bizarre coming from the guy who is called the father of the animal rights movement. I mean, that's a very, very strange thing to say. Now, I understand that Singer's got an interest in promoting things like the animal compassionate standards and all this happy meat exploitation. And so one way he does that is to say, well, the animals don't care. This is an idea that he gets from Jeremy Bentham, who wrote about it in the early 18th century. Jeremy Bentham took the position, well, the cow doesn't care that we kill and eat her. She just cares about how we treat her in the meantime. And I think that notion, which is presented as an empirical fact about animal cognition, is just plain wrong. It's just plain wrong. And I must be onto something because so far, several professors have tried to arrange interviews and discussions between me and Singer on this point at various universities, and he refuses to do it. So I assume I must be onto something because Peter doesn't want to discuss this issue publicly, and I don't think there's an answer to it. I mean, I honestly don't think that there's an answer to it. I think Steiner would agree with me that there is not an answer to it. I don't want to put any words in Gary's mouth, but I think he would agree with me that there's really no philosophical answer to the position that to say that an interest in life is linked with human-like self-awareness, the ability to recognize oneself in the mirror, the ability to have reflective thoughts about one's conscious states, those sorts of things that we associate with human-like self-awareness. The idea that that's the only way you can have an interest in life is itself a speciesist proposition.
Some very dense information, Professor Francione. I so much appreciate your time for joining us on Radioactive Lunch for the second annual Animal Day with the Vegan Initiative. People should check out the abolitionistapproach.com online and your fine works and your latest book just out, The Animal Rights Debate. Once again, we very much appreciate your time and great words.
Thank you, and please keep promoting veganism. It's easy, it's better for your health, it's better for the planet, and most importantly, it's the morally right thing to do. It's what we owe to animals. It's not a matter of compassion. It's a matter of justice. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Thanks,
pleasure
Gary.
Take care.
You're awesome.
Bye-bye. Take care.
Awesome
Thank
vegan.
You. Bye-bye.
Indeed.